Welcome to the Deep Dive. This is where we carve through dense information and bring you the most essential knowledge nuggets, tailor-made just for you.
And we've got quite an issue today. It really bridges immense human suffering with some incredible technological promise. We're talking global conflict, political shifts, and even, you know, the cutting edge of robotics.
That's right. We are embarking on a thorough, comprehensive, and exhaustive deep dive into Time Magazine, October 27th, 2025. I'm Andy Byron.
And I'm Chris Cabot. I'm here to help unpack the context, synthesize the insights, and really explore the deep implications of, well, pretty much every major article and brief in this absolutely packed issue.
Yeah, our mission today is to pull out those critical connections so you, the listener, walk away feeling genuinely well-informed.
Let's get into it.
Okay, we really have to start with the anchor feature. It begins on page 28, and it offers just the most visceral view of ongoing conflict. We're talking about the excerpts from Eli Sharabi's memoir, Hostage.
Right, and this was released on the second anniversary of the October 7th attacks. It's significant because it's the first published first-person narrative from an Israeli held captive in Gaza.
And the duration is just staggering.
It really is. Sharabi spent 491 days in captivity, almost 500 days. He was captured in those terrifying opening hours of the attack, pulled away from his wife and two daughters in Biri.
And taken with someone else, right?
Yes, alongside a Thai farm worker. Two men from, you know, completely different worlds suddenly bound together by this shared terror.
The description of his arrival in Gaza, it's horrific. Less like capture, more like, well, an attempted lynching is how it sounds.
Absolutely. Yeah. He describes being dragged into the strip, still wrapped in a blanket from his bed, and then just hearing this overwhelming noise. He called it an ecstatic screaming crowd.
Like ecstatic.
Yeah, a screaming, joyous mob fighting over him, trying to literally rip him apart. The hatred, the excitement, it was almost immediate death.
So how did he survive that moment?
It was only because Hamas militants intervened. They saw him as, well, valuable cargo, essentially. Yeah. They pulled him back into a building.
And that building turned out to be a mosque.
That's right. He realized it from the prayer rugs. That contrast, the immediate threat of being torn apart, then finding himself inside a place of worship, it's deeply unsettling. And it really sets the tone for the psychological manipulation that followed.
After interrogation, they moved him. And this is where his biggest fear kicked in, the tunnels.
Exactly. He'd seen the news reports, the images. He was bracing himself for, you know, total crushing darkness, being buried alive.
But that wasn't the initial reality.
No. And this is a chilling detail about Hamas's preparations. He climbs down this long ladder, maybe 100 feet underground. But at the bottom, it wasn't raw earth. It was adapted. Fluorescent lights, ceramic tiles on the walls, a sink, a kitchen, even a basic bathroom.
Wow, like a hidden layer of infrastructure.
Precisely. A sort of secondary civilization hidden deep beneath Gaza.
And who was down there with him initially?
His first companions were Ori and Hirsch. Hirsch was missing an arm. Both were survivors of the Nova Festival attack.
So you had the kibbutznik, Sharabi, and these festival survivors thrown together by just indiscriminate violence.
Yeah, that shared identity, however horrific the circumstances, must have been some kind of initial comfort, a lifeline maybe.
But that didn't last, did it? The conditions deteriorated.
Dramatically. Hmm? After January 2024, he was moved. Moved to a deeper tunnel, one that was far less equipped. Hmm. This new place lacked basic supplies. They couldn't even get a simple landline set up, which suggests it was maybe more temporary or hastily built.
And that's where the real physical hardship began, the starvation.
Oh, absolutely. The scarcity of food was shocking. He talks about weeks where they survived on just two or three biscuits twice a day. That's it.
Just biscuits.
For days on end. Then periods where they got nothing but raw full beans. Imagine trying to eat raw beans. Later, when they did get some stale pitas and cream cheese, the rationing was extreme. One small can of cream cheese per day shared among four men. He writes about saving the very last bite, just to try and fall asleep with some sensation other than emptiness in his stomach.
It's hard to even comprehend. And the hygiene situation?
It's a crisis. Yeah. Deliberate neglect, it sounds like. Weeks without showering, no toilet paper.
Yeah.
And critically, the raw sewage pit beneath their makeshift toilet stopped draining.
Oh, no.
Yeah, the waste literally started rising to the surface in their tiny cell. This led to constant debilitating health problems, fungal infections, vomiting, diarrhea. It really suggests the militants holding them were either too preoccupied, too disorganized, or frankly just didn't care about their slow decay.
It's just absolute degradation, yet somehow, in the midst of all this, he found strength. He wasn't religious before.
And he gives himself secular, yeah.
Yeah.
But he found profound strength in traditional Jewish rituals. It's an incredible example of the human spirit finding meaning even in that kind of void.
How did that manifest day to day?
Well, these rituals became like mental armor. He describes how another hostage, Ilya, who grew up religious, would recite the traditional morning prayers. And the others, including Sharabi, would respond Amen.
A shared moment of affirmation.
Exactly. And every Friday night, Shabbat, they'd gather for Kiddush, the blessing over wine, but using a cup of water instead.
And he taught Ilya a prayer.
He did. He taught him the words to Eshet Sheol, the Woman of Valor prayer, traditionally recited to honor one's wife on Shabbat. They used these times to share memories of Shabbat dinners back home.
So it wasn't just about survival, it was about identity.
Absolutely. Reinforcing who they were as men, as fathers, as Jews, connecting back to their families, their lives. It elevated the struggle beyond just, you know, animal survival. There's a conscious act of holding onto their humanity.
The ending of his captivity, though, the release, it sounds almost as cruel as the captivity itself.
It was bizarrely humiliating. This dress rehearsal for their release in February 2025, suddenly they're given these new, identical, frankly ugly brown suits. Blindfolded for the car ride out, partly to avoid IDF attack, partly to avoid an angry mob.
And then coached.
Meticulously coached by a Hebrew-speaking Hamas member on exactly what to say, how to walk, and crucially, when to smile for the cameras.
So turning their freedom into propaganda.
Precisely. A final, manipulative, stage-managed spectacle. Sharabi said his only goal at that point was just to perform it perfectly. Don't mess up. Don't jeopardize the release. Just get through the performance.
What a harrowing, detailed account of the human cost. It really grounds the reality of conflict.
It does. And pulling back from that intense personal story, you see how the same global forces, the instability fueling that conflict, are also driving these huge economic shifts elsewhere, particularly this rush for mineral wealth.
Which brings us neatly to the feature on page 36, All That Glitters. It's about the new gold rush, centered this time in Ghana.
Right. Ghana. Historically, the Gold Coast. It's Africa's top gold exporter today, number six globally. Gold has always been, you know, Ghana's blessing in many ways.
But now it's becoming a curse.
Increasingly, yes. Because of this explosion in illegal wildcat mining, locally, it's called Galamsey.
And the scale is enormous, right?
It's staggering. Over 1.5 million Ghanaians are estimated to be working in Galamsey. And you can see why the money's a huge lure. They can earn around 1,000 Ghanaian cedis. About $81 per week.
Which is how much compared to the minimum wage?
8 times the national minimum wage. So when formal jobs are scarce, that kind of income is almost impossible for people, especially young men, to ignore. It represents opportunity, however dangerous.
But the environmental cost is devastating.
Ruinous. To get the gold out of the sediment, these small-scale miners use poisonous mercury. And that mercury just flows directly into rivers, streams, farmland.
And mercury stays toxic for how long?
Potentially 1,000 years. It contaminates the water, the fish, the crops. Mm-hmm. It leads to chronic illness, neurological damage, terrible birth defects in the communities downstream. There's a quote from a former EPA official in Ghana saying, basically, we are slowly poisoning ourselves for immediate profit.
Is the government trying to stop it?
The current government, under President John Mahama, yeah, they've made fighting Galamsey a signature policy. They've banned foreigners from trading gold locally and set up something called GoldBod, the Gold Bulk Export Department.
GoldBod. What's the gold then?
To be the sole legitimate exporter. The idea is to try and channel this wealth back into the state coffers, manage it responsibly, and cut out the illegal trade.
But this isn't just a local issue, is it? There are bigger forces at play.
Oh, absolutely. Their efforts are happening against this backdrop of intense geopolitical dynamics. This gold rush isn't spontaneous. It's being driven by international powers reacting to global economic uncertainty.
China seems to be a major factor.
Analysts agree, yeah. Beijing is seen as the primary driver. They've been covertly stockpiling gold. Why? Well, partly to hedge against potential U.S. sanctions or punitive measures, and partly to reduce their reliance on the U.S. dollar as a global reserve currency.
How much are they buying?
They officially bought 630 tons last year alone. But here's the kicker. Analysts cited in the piece believe China's true holdings are likely more than double the official figure of 2,530 tons.
Double? That's a huge discrepancy.
It signals a deep mistrust in the current U.S. dollar-dominated financial system. They're quietly building up an alternative reserve.
Does the U.S. play a role in this gold rush dynamic?
Indirectly, yes. The article points to Trump-era tariffs, which spurred global gold buying as a general hedge against market instability, but also cuts to U.S. foreign aid. The piece mentions $156 million slashed from Ghana specifically.
How does that connect?
Well, it puts pressure on developing nations like Ghana. They need to plug those funding gaps somehow. And often, the quickest way is through exploiting their own mineral wealth, even if it means tolerating or turning a blind eye to environmentally destructive practices like the LAMSI.
And this high demand for gold, especially untraceable gold, fuels worse things.
Definitely. It fuels organized crime and conflict worldwide. The article mentions estimates of 50,000 illegal Chinese prospectors now operating just in Ghana.
50,000?
Just in Ghana. Globally, the numbers are massive. Something like $7 billion in gold is smuggled annually just out of the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo. Maybe the most direct link. Russia's Wagner mercenary group is estimated to have used $2.5 billion worth of African gold smuggled gold to help fund the war in Ukraine.
So gold is basically untraceable conflict funding.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which brings us to the key choke point in this illicit trade.
Yeah.
The UAE, specifically Dubai.
Dubai. How are they involved?
A SwissAid report is cited, showing that about 40% of all African gold exports are undeclared, basically smuggled. And of that smuggled gold, a staggering 93% goes straight to the UAE.
93%?
Yeah. It strongly suggests a systemic, no-questions-asked approach in Dubai's gold markets. They provide the essential liquidity, the place to sell this smuggled gold, which in turn fuels the conflicts and the environmental damage back in Africa.
So, given this huge global black market, how can Ghana possibly fight back?
Their strategy, centered on this gold bite entity, is actually quite smart. By centralizing exports, they're trying to gain control, and they've significantly boosted their central bank. Gold reserves quadrupled them to nearly 40 tons in just 2 years.
And that helps how?
It's helped stabilize their currency, the cedi. It's strengthened by about 30%. But the really ambitious next step is this new commercial refinery they're building.
A refinery? Why is that key?
They're aiming for LBMA good delivery list status. That's the London Bullion Market Association, the international gold standard. Getting on that list is crucial. It means your gold is trusted, transparent, legitimate, and can be traded on the world's biggest market in London.
Who has that status in Africa now?
Currently, only South Africa. So if Ghana achieves this, it would be huge. It could provide transparency, legitimacy, and potentially isolate the black market buyers who rely on that lack of scrutiny.
So the bigger picture here is gold acting like, well, like old school geopolitical money again.
Precisely. It's untraceable. It's fungible. Hmm. It allows sanctioned states, criminal groups, terrorist organizations to bypass the dollar-based financial system. It really highlights this direct clash between geopolitical instability and the desperate need for sustainable local development.
That instability, that tension you mentioned between global forces and local politics, it feels like a perfect lead-in to the next section, specifically the essay in the View section called World History Unended.
Yeah, it tackles the erosion of liberal democracy head-on.
And it's framed as a direct response, or maybe a refutation, of Francis Fukuyama's famous end of history idea from back in 1989.
Right. Fukuyama argued, after the Berlin Wall fell, that liberal democracy had basically won the ideological battle. There were no serious competitors left. But this essay says, well, that optimism is now definitively over.
When did things start to turn, according to the article?
The author points to around 2005 as the global turning point. That's when political scientists started tracking what they call the democratic recession, the period where the number of countries experiencing democratic declines started consistently outnumbering those making gains.
And it wasn't sudden collapses, but a slower process.
Exactly. Not typically violent coups, but this slow, insidious decay from within.
What are the symptoms they identify?
They're familiar signs, unfortunately seen across the different continents. Weakening the rule of law, deliberately undermining the independence of the judiciary, chipping away at free speech protections, increasingly corrupt elections.
And maybe the most corrosive sign.
Parties refusing to accept election results. That's highlighted as crucial. Democracies in the 21st century aren't usually dying violently. They're being dismantled legally, often by leaders who were legitimately elected but then used their power to weaken the very system that brought them there. Checks and balances eroded from the inside.
The article identifies a specific ideological shift driving this, something about the 19th century.
Yeah, it argues we're seeing a return to 19th century style politics, specifically the rise of what it calls soft fascism.
Soft fascism, what does that entail?
It's not necessarily characterized by, you know, uniforms and street violence in the classic sense. It's more about ultranationalism, xenophobia, a drift towards authoritarianism, and this really interesting concept the author calls toxic nostalgia.
Toxic nostalgia, that's a powerful phrase. What does it mean?
Think about the slogans. Make America Great Again. Or similar refrains you hear in Hungary, India, elsewhere. The article argues that beneath the surface, this often translates to something like make country X white again, or culturally pure again. It's driven by deep anxieties about immigration, demographic change, a perceived loss of a traditional national identity.
So it's looking backward, not forward.
Exactly. It directly clashes with that hopeful linear view of history. You know, the idea that the moral arc of the universe bends towards justice, which has always been central to democratic idealism.
So the takeaway is, we can't just assume things will get better on their own.
Pretty much. Yeah. If we want that moral arc to bend, the essay argues, we have to actively bend it ourselves. It stresses individual engagement, even quoting Judge Learned Hand from 1944. Liberty lies in the hearts of men and women. When it dies there, no constitution, no law, no court can save it.
Wow. So voting, protesting, these aren't just rights, they're responsibilities.
The essay frames them as essential democratic superpowers in this new era of ideological struggle, which actually perfectly sets the stage for looking at the political battles playing out right now in places like Argentina.
Yes, President Javier Milei, the self-described anarcho-capitalist. The article suggests his momentum is hitting some serious roadblocks.
Big time. He's facing real vulnerability ahead of the October 26th midterm elections. His whole radical move fast and break things approach seems to be colliding with the hard reality of legislative resistance. He just doesn't have the votes.
What's the evidence for that faltering momentum?
It's pretty stark and specific in the piece. Lawmakers have resoundingly overturned two of his critical vetoes recently.
Which ones?
One was for new funding for public universities. That veto was overturned in the Senate by a massive 59-7 vote. Basically unanimous opposition.
59-7? Ouch.
Yeah. In another veto, this one blocking new money for pediatric health care was also overturned 58-7.
These weren't minor issues either. Universities, children's health.
Exactly. High profile social issues. His argument was basically the country can't afford this right now. But the legislature, across party lines, essentially said, yes, we can and we must. It made him look really out of touch with basic public priorities.
And there are other problems compounding this. Scandals?
Yes. Corruption allegations are hitting his party hard. The head of his Liberty Advances ticket in Buenos Aires, José Luis Espert, has been linked in reports to drug trafficking and money laundering.
That's particularly damaging for Milei, isn't it, given his platform?
Hugely damaging. He ran hard on being anti-corruption, tough on crime. But now, public anger over rising violence from drug gangs is actually increasing, and his own party is getting tainted by these kinds of allegations. It undercuts his core message.
What about the economic front? Didn't he promise help from the U.S.?
He did, or at least hinted at it. There was talk of major financial help from the Trump administration, potentially. But the article says that's now looking unlikely before the midterms. And even if it did happen, the conditions were clarified. It would likely only be a currency swap, basically. A loan to shore up Argentina's reserves, not the U.S. buying Argentine debt, which is what Milei might have hoped for. Ooh. So no big external bailout is coming to boost his standing right now.
So what does this all mean for the midterms?
The implications look pretty bad for him. His party already holds very few seats in Congress. Projections cited in the article suggest they're set to significantly underperform, likely getting under 40% of the vote nationwide.
And with that kind of weakness?
It means his really controversial plans, like the promised complete devaluation of the peso, or dollarization, become virtually impossible to push through Congress. He'll be forced to make major concessions to allies just to get anything done, significantly watering down his radical agenda.
So the charismatic appeal isn't enough when you can't deliver legislatively.
Seems that way. And when that kind of strongman momentum starts to falter, where do they often turn their attention?
Towards critics, silencing dissent.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which brings us, quite chillingly, to this next piece on the attack on laughter, the censorship of comedians.
It's a pattern, isn't it? Authoritarians often go after comedians first.
Historically, yes. Laughter is seen as power, as dissent. It punctures pomposity. The article mentions examples like Jadrach Mirzalizade jailed in Russia, Bassem Youssef forced out of Egypt. Humor is threatening to those who demand absolute respect.
And the U.S. example highlighted here is the Jimmy Kimmel situation.
Right, the temporary suspension of Jimmy Kimmel Live. by ABC after he made some jokes about the Magag gang. But the crucial point the article makes is this wasn't just, you know, corporate jitters about audience complaints.
What was it then?
The article's clear. It was direct government interference.
How so? Who interfered?
FCC Chair Brendan Carr. He publicly threatened Disney, which is ABC's parent company, with regulatory consequences if they didn't take action against Kimmel.
He threatened them? How explicitly?
The quote cited is pretty blunt. We could do this the easy way or the hard way.
Wow. Coming from the head of the FCC, that's serious pressure.
It's serious leverage. We need to unpack that mechanism. It wasn't a formal legal order, it seems, but political bullying. Using the implicit threat of the FCC's regulatory power, things like license renewals, investigations to pressure a media company into silencing speech the official didn't like.
So not cancel culture from the audience.
No. The article stresses this point. This isn't the market or viewers reacting. This is a government official using the threat of state power to suppress dissent. That's authoritarianism. Plain and simple.
And there's hypocrisy involved, too.
Huge hypocrisy. Carr has previously presented himself as a big defender of free speech, railing against quote-unquote woke censorship. But here he is, using the government's power to try and silence political humor he personally disagrees with.
Kimmel came back on air quickly, though. Doesn't that mitigate it?
The article argues no, not really. The fact that Disney caved, even temporarily, under that pressure is the fundamental failure. Demonstrates that we can't necessarily rely on large corporate media outlets to be the brave, consistent defenders of the First Amendment when facing direct government threats.
So who does that leave?
The burden falls back on citizens, on comedians themselves, on independent journalists to refuse to be intimidated.
It's interesting, too, the article notes the relative silence from many usual free speech warriors during this incident.
Yeah, that's a telling point. People who are very vocal about, say, campus speech codes or social media moderation were often quiet when the actual government, via the FCC, was threatening a major network. It suggests a selective defense of free speech, maybe loud when punching down, but quiet when the state itself is doing the punching.
Okay, from battles over free speech, let's shift to another really charged domestic issue, one deeply tied to ideological divides in the U.S., the landscape after the Dobbs decision and this rise of baby boxes. That's covered on page 44.
Right. This is a really complex and, frankly, quite sad societal response, playing out mainly in states that have severely restricted or banned abortion since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022.
So what exactly are these baby boxes?
They're basically temperature-controlled bassinets. They get installed in the walls of designated safe havens, usually hospitals or fire stations. Over 18 states, mostly conservative ones, have approved their use now.
And the idea is safe surrender.
Exactly. Advocates, often from the pro-life movement, see them as a final, safe, and completely anonymous option for a parent, usually a mother in crisis, to surrender an unwanted newborn without resorting to illegal abandonment, which can obviously have tragic consequences.
There's a quote from an Alabama representative.
Yeah, Matt Simpson. He said, to be a pro-life state, you have to give options. So the box is framed as that last resort option. They cost about $16,000 each, trigger a silent alarm when an infant is placed inside, and provide an orange bag with some information for the parent.
But they're controversial.
Highly controversial. The article details significant opposition, citing a letter signed by dozens of doctors, ethicists, and adoption lawyers.
What are their main concerns?
They raise several issues. First, basic safety and regulation. Often these boxes are installed without clear standards for inspection or maintenance, raising concerns about potential malfunctions, temperature issues, things that could endanger the infant.
Okay, that's a practical concern. What about the human side?
That's maybe more critical. They argue the complete anonymity of the box prevents any chance for face-to-face counseling or support for the mother. Surrendering a child is often an incredibly traumatic event associated with deep, long-lasting grief. The box system offers no support network for the mother at that moment of crisis.
And the impact on the child?
That's another major ethical objection.
Yeah.
Total anonymity means the child is completely cut off from their medical history, their family history. This isn't just about identity later in life. It can have serious implications for their long-term health care if genetic predispositions are unknown.
Are there legal concerns too?
Yes. Law enforcement officials and child welfare advocates worry that the boxes could inadvertently facilitate or conceal crimes, things like statutory rape, incest, even trafficking. Because there's no human interaction, no questions asked, it bypasses any scrutiny of the circumstances surrounding the surrender.
Beyond the ethics, do we know if they even work? Do they reduce infant abandonment?
That's a key point the critics raise. There's actually very little evidence that they do. Studies from Germany, where these boxes first appeared around the year 2000, have consistently failed to show any measurable reduction in illegal abandonment rates or infant deaths.
So the argument is the money could be better spent elsewhere.
Precisely. At $16,000 plus per box, plus installation and upkeep, critics argue that money would be far more effective if invested in proven alternatives. Things like direct financial aid for struggling mothers, housing support, mental health counseling, substance abuse treatment, addressing the root causes of why a mother might feel forced to surrender her child in the first place.
Is there an alternative model that addresses some of these concerns?
Yes. The article mentions the confidential birth model, which is used successfully in countries like Germany and Japan.
How does that work differently?
It tries to balance the need for privacy with the child's right to know their history. In this model, the mother can give birth anonymously in a hospital setting, receiving prenatal care and counseling. But her identifying information is recorded confidentially and sealed.
And the child can access it later.
Yes. Usually upon turning 16 or 18, the child has the legal right to access that sealed information. So it provides the mother with anonymity during the crisis, but preserves the child's connection to their medical history and identity. It avoids the ethical pitfalls of the completely anonymous box system.
So it's really a conflict between a quick, tech-based, anonymous fix versus a more complex, human-centered support system.
That sums it up well. One prioritizes immediate anonymous disposal. The other prioritizes support for both mother and child, acknowledging the long-term implications.
All right, let's shift from that specific issue to some broader public health bulletins in this issue. These give us a snapshot of some really fast-moving trends affecting Americans, starting with the drug landscape. There's a new opioid threat.
Yes, a significant one. Amid all the intense crackdowns on fentanyl, a new class of synthetic opioids is emerging called nitazenes. These are basically analogs or chemical cousins of fentanyl, but some of them are reported to be exponentially more potent.
More potent than fentanyl? That's terrifying.
It really is. Scientists quoted in the brief are calling this a unique inflection point in the drug supply chain. It demonstrates that awful dynamic known as the iron law of prohibition.
Remind us what that is.
It's the principle that when law enforcement cracks down hard on a widely available illicit substance, the market inevitably shifts towards more potent, easier to smuggle alternatives. It maximizes profit per volume and reduces trafficking risk. We saw it when heroin was largely replaced by the far more potent fentanyl over the last decade or so.
And now fentanyl might be getting replaced by something even stronger.
That appears to be the trend, driven by the same market logic. And the source is shifting, too.
How so?
Fentanyl production is largely controlled by cartels in Mexico. Nitazenes, however, seem to be primarily produced in labs in China and then shipped directly or through other international routes.
So it's a different supply chain.
Largely distinct, yes. Though the article notes they often overlap regionally in distribution networks. This just increases the danger, as users might encounter these incredibly potent nitazenes without even knowing it, mixed into other drugs.
Okay, next bulletin point. ICE detentions. There's data here that seems to contradict the official narrative.
Very much so. The Trump administration has consistently pushed the line that its immigration enforcement, particularly mass deportations and detentions, prioritizes the worst of the worst serious criminals.
But the data says otherwise.
The data, collected as of late September and cited in the magazine, paints a very different picture of who is actually being held in ICE detention centers.
What's it show?
Get this. More than 70% of the nearly 60,000 people held by ICE at that time had no prior criminal convictions at all.
70%? None.
None. And even more striking, nearly half, almost 28,000 people, had neither a criminal conviction nor any pending criminal charges against them.
So just people picked up for immigration violations?
Primarily, yes. And data from the Cato Institute, also cited, found that only 6.9% of all ICE detainees had actually been convicted of violent crimes.
6.9%. That's a huge gap between the worst of the worst rhetoric and the reality.
It's a massive gap. It strongly suggests that the current detention and deportation machine is targeting a much, much broader population than just dangerous criminals, raising serious questions about the alignment of stated policy goals and operational reality.
Okay, switching gears to personal health, there's a brief about feet. Seems trivial, but apparently not.
No, surprisingly important. One podiatrist quoted calls feet a window to the rest of your health. Because they're so far from the heart, circulation issues often show up there first. It can be early warning signs for serious systemic illnesses.
Like what? What should people look out for?
Your article lists five specific foot symptoms you should never ignore. First, hair suddenly stops growing on your toes.
Hair on toes.
Yeah. If it stops growing, it can indicate poor blood flow or vascular insufficiency, which could be linked to heart disease or blocked arteries.
Okay, what else?
Second, sudden severe pain and swelling, usually the big toe. That's the classic sign of gout, a type of inflammatory arthritis caused by uric acid buildup.
Number three.
Persistent numbness or tingling, especially if it gets worse at night. This is often neuropathy, nerve damage, and it's frequently linked to undiagnosed or poorly controlled diabetes. Super common. Very important warning sign.
What's the fourth one? This sounds serious.
It is a dark streak or line appearing under a toenail. People might dismiss it as a bruise from bumping their toe, but it absolutely needs to be checked by a doctor immediately. It could be subungual melanoma.
Melanoma under the toenail.
Yes, a rare but potentially lethal form of skin cancer. It's treatable if caught very early, but often missed because of its location.
Okay, and the fifth symptom.
Pretty straightforward.
Right.
If you injure your foot and you still can't bear weight on it after 3 or 4 days, don't just assume it's a sprain. It could easily be a fracture or a dislocation that needs proper medical attention. So, simple advice, but tied to potentially serious underlying issues.
Good to know. Finally, in public health, climate change, and fall leaves.
Yeah, it sounds quaint, but fall foliage is a major economic driver, especially in places like New England, and climate change is messing with it.
How does the color change work normally?
It's triggered by two things: shorter days and cooler temperatures. This causes the green chlorophyll in the leaves to break down. As the green fades, other pigments that were already there, yellows and oranges, become visible.
What about the reds?
Reds, especially maples, are different. The tree actually creates those red pigments new in the fall. They act sort of like a sunscreen, protecting the leaf as it prepares to drop, allowing the tree to reabsorb maximum nutrients.
So how is climate change affecting this?
In a couple of ways, warmer nights in particular interfere with the chemical processes needed to produce those vibrant reds and golds, so the colors end up being duller.
And the timing is off too.
Yes, warmer overall summers and autumns delay the whole process. The article mentions that in Maine, the peak foliage has been shifting later by almost a full day each decade.
What about rainfall? Does that matter?
Big time. Drought is a major problem. If it's too dry, the leaves can just sort of crisp up and fall off the trees early, skipping the color change altogether. It's called drought scorch.
So, what's the prediction for this year's foliage season?
Based on the erratic rainfall and drought patterns recently, the prediction for New England is that the season will be bright, brief, and early, meaning the colors might pop intensely, but for a much shorter window and sooner than usual.
And that impacts tourism.
Absolutely. That fall foliage season is estimated to be an $8 billion economy for New England. A compressed, unpredictable season really disrupts tourism planning and hits local businesses hard.
All right, from those immediate health and environmental concerns, let's pivot to the future, the really cutting edge of technology and innovation. This issue includes the big Best Inventions 2025 list.
Yeah, it's always a fascinating section. They recognize 300 inventions overall, but the magazine highlights 50, and it just shows the sheer breadth and accelerating pace of change across almost every field imaginable.
Where should we start? Maybe food and drink?
Okay, yeah, some cool stuff there. There's Savor Butter. It's a lab-grown fat, but chemically it matches real butter. The big win: dramatically lower CO2 emissions compared to traditional dairy farming. Huge potential for sustainability.
Lab-grown butter. What else?
Wild-type salmon Saku. This is significant because it's the first FDA-approved cell-grown seafood to actually hit the market. Cultivated salmon, no fishing involved.
And bananas that don't brown.
Exactly. The Tropic Non-Browning Banana. This uses precision gene editing, not GMO in the old sense, but targeted edits to extend the shelf life. Think about how much fruit spoils during transport. This could dramatically reduce food waste in global supply chains.
Okay, what about energy? Anything stand out?
Definitely the Polarnite Energy Sand Battery from Finland. This is really clever. It takes excess renewable energy, like wind or solar, and stores it as heat, super high heat, up to 1,000 degrees Celsius, in a huge insulated container of ordinary sand.
Storing heat in sand, how is that used?
They then use that stored heat to heat water for a local district heating system. It's already heating about 5,000 residents in one Finnish town. It offers a potentially cheap, scalable solution for long-duration energy storage, which is a huge challenge for renewables.
Health innovations always seem groundbreaking. What's new there?
Two really stand out. First, Abbott's iStat TDI. It's a blood test that can detect specific proteins released after a traumatic brain injury, like a concussion.
How fast is it?
15 minutes. At the point of care, like in an ER or even sidelined at a game, it's a much faster, cheaper alternative to sending someone for a CT scan, potentially speeding up diagnosis and treatment significantly.
15 minutes? Wow. And the other one?
Even more futuristic, maybe. The synchronous Stentrode. This is a brain-computer interface, or DCI. But the key difference is how it's implanted.
No open brain surgery.
Exactly. Surgeons actually guide it through a blood vessel in the neck, up into the brain, and deploy it near the motor cortex, like inserting a stent in a heart vessel. It then picks up brain signals.
So people could control devices with thought, without major surgery.
That's the goal, primarily for people with severe paralysis. It dramatically lowers the risk compared to earlier BCIs that required drilling into the skull. This could potentially move BCIs from niche experiments towards being a more scalable medical technology.
What about consumer tech? Any big highlights?
Well, the expected buzz around the new Nintendo Switch 2. It gets an upgrade to 4K resolution when docked to a TV, and a bigger, nicer 7.9-inch handheld screen. Apparently, it sold 3.5 million units in its first week.
Still huge demand for Nintendo.
Absolutely. Proves that blend of nostalgia, innovation, and portability is still a winning formula. And speaking of nostalgia, there's the Camp Snap camera.
What's that?
It's a simple digital camera, but it has no screen. The idea is to replicate that feeling of taking pictures with a disposable camera back in the 90s. You just point, shoot, and don't know what you got until later.
Yeah.
Tapping into that desire for less screen time, more authentic moments.
Interesting. Okay, so lots of cool individual inventions, but the feature on humanoid robotics feels like it's pointing towards something much bigger, maybe more disruptive.
Oh, absolutely. Specifically, the focus is on Figure AI and its latest model, the Figure 03 robot. This isn't just another gadget. It suggests a fundamental transformation of labor and maybe society itself is coming much faster than people realize.
The money involved is staggering, right?
It really signals the level of conviction in the tech industry. Figure AI just raised another $1 billion, valuing the company at $39 billion. And look who's investing. NVIDIA, Jeff Bezos, OpenAI. The heavy hitters are betting big.
What's their ultimate goal? General robotics.
Exactly. That means creating a humanoid robot that can navigate the messy, unpredictable, real world as fluidly as a person can. Not just repetitive tasks in a factory, but handling novel situations, adapting on the fly.
And they're aiming for the home market.
Aggressively. CEO Brett Adcock is quoted saying they aim to have robots in every home by 2026. He calculates the potential market, basically all global labor that could theoretically be automated at $40
trillion. $40 trillion. That's almost unimaginable. What makes the Figure 03 model such a leap?
It's smaller, the joints are more robust, and crucially, the components are apparently 90% cheaper to manufacture than their previous models. And the hands are key. They now have sophisticated tactile sensors on the finger pads, allowing for much finer manipulation.
What kind of tasks are they testing?
Things like loading a dishwasher, clearing plates from a table, basic tidying. The article notes, though, that folding laundry remains the sort of Mount Everest challenge for robot dexterity. Still, really hard.
How do they train these robots so quickly?
This is where their tech seems really advanced. They use an internal neural network called Helix. It's structured kind of like human cognition. There's a system zero for basic reflexes like balance, trained mostly in simulation. System one is like the nervous system, handling immediate sensory input and motor control.
And system two?
That's the logical brain, the reasoning model. It's trained on vast amounts of internet text and images, similar to large language models, giving it contextual understanding of the world.
And they use human pilots.
Yeah. Humans wearing VR headsets literally drive the robot performing tasks. They film this from the robot's perspective, generating training data incredibly efficiently. This is why Figure 03 reportedly learned to fold a towel from only 80 hours of video, whereas older robots might need thousands of hours for a complex task.
80 hours. That's fast.
Adcock is super confident because of this rapid data scaling. He predicts they'll essentially solve general robotics within 18 to 24 months.
If he's right, the implications are massive, both good and bad.
Huge. Adcock paints the optimistic picture. Robotics will collapse the cost of practically all goods and services, leading to immense wealth creation. But the flip side is potentially mass unemployment, as human labor becomes redundant across many sectors.
Which leads to calls for things like UBI.
Exactly. he explicitly mentions that a universal basic income might become necessary to prevent societal collapse if the value of labor plummets that drastically.
What about safety? A robot making a mistake in your home could be dangerous.
That's a profound concern raised in the article. What happens if the AI hallucinates, makes an unexpected incorrect action while operating unsupervised around people, pets, fragile objects? They say the Figaro 3 is designed to be physically overpowerable by a human, but ensuring long-term safety and reliability in millions of unique, unpredictable home environments is arguably a much harder problem than the core engineering.
And the ethics of data collection.
Also critical. Figure plans to use data gathered from these home robots. Video of them doing tasks, mapping your house layout to continuously train and improve future models. This requires incredibly strict, foolproof methods for scrubbing and anonymizing personal information. As one expert in the piece puts it, the biggest challenge might not be the technology itself, but developing the political will and the social contract to manage this transition ethically and prevent creating a permanent, unemployable underclass.
Wow. Heavy stuff. Before we move on from tech and science, there are two quick but really vital updates here. One on AI competition, the other a major health breakthrough.
Right. First, AI. Despite all the U.S. efforts to control chip exports, the article highlights that Chinese companies are catching up fast in generative AI. ByteDance, the TikTok parent company, is mentioned specifically.
What have they released?
Powerful new tools. CDance for generating video from text prompts and CDream for creating images. They're seen as rapidly closing the gap with U.S. competitors like OpenAI and Google.
What's the main risk here?
It's twofold, really. These increasingly sophisticated tools make creating convincing deepfake, fake videos, fake images incredibly cheap and easy. This fuels misinformation and propaganda efforts globally. And second, these models often freely reproduce copyrighted material in their outputs, creating huge legal and ethical headaches for creators.
What's the solution? Can we even stop it?
Experts quoted stress that focusing only on the technology is probably futile. The real key is investing heavily in media literacy and critical thinking skills for the public. Because, as one person put it, we're entering an era where people can simultaneously believe nothing and anything. You need the skills to evaluate sources critically.
Okay, and the health breakthrough. This sounds amazing.
It really does. It's about a potentially transformative gene therapy for Huntington's disease, reported by a company called UniEra.
Huntington's, that's the devastating neurodegenerative disease, right?
Right.
Inherited progressive.
Yeah. Exactly. Currently untreatable. But in this study, surgeons injected a specially designed gene therapy directly into the brains of patients. This therapy carries instructions telling the brain cells to essentially turn off the production of the faulty Huntington protein that causes the disease.
Targeting the root cause. Did it work?
The results reported are stunning. Patients who received the high dose of this therapy showed a 75% slowing in the progression of their symptoms over a 3-year period compared to control groups who didn't get the active therapy.
75% slowing. That's incredible for Huntington's.
It's potentially life-changing, offering real hope where there was basically none before. UniEra is apparently planning to submit this for accelerated FDA approval sometime next year. Just a massive potential leap forward.
Okay, from the high-tech lab, let's shift focus slightly to the natural world and human legacies. The magazine notes the recent passing of Jane Goodall. She was 91.
An absolute icon. Her work fundamentally changed how we see ourselves and our closest animal relatives, the chimpanzees.
She was the one who first documented tool use, right?
Yes. That famous observation of chimps using sticks, modified sticks even, to fish termites out of mounds. It shattered the long-held belief that humans were the only tool-using species. A huge blow to human exceptionalism at the time.
But she also showed their darker side.
She did. Her long-term studies in Gombe revealed complex social behaviors that weren't always pleasant. Chimps eating meat, engaging in organized conflict, basically warfare, between groups, even instances of cannibalism. It shattered the romantic image some had of peaceful primates.
But she documented the gentle side, too.
Oh, absolutely. Meticulously. Their capacity for play, for deep bonds, for what looked undeniably like profound grief when a mother lost an infant, for example. And that incredible moment early on when a young chimp, Flint, reached out and touched her nose, a sign of acceptance, bridging that gap between species. She truly became an ambassador.
What was her final message, according to the piece?
Even at the end, her focus was powerfully on hope. Not ignoring the problems, but emphasizing hope over despair and apathy, especially regarding the environment. She was a tireless advocate for reforestation, for protecting plant life, and urge young people particularly not to give in to doom and gloom, arguing that hope itself is the catalyst needed for positive action.
A powerful legacy. Now, shifting to politics and another kind of legacy, potentially a first in Japan.
Yes, the selection of Sanae Takahashi as the new leader of Japan's ruling Liberal Democratic Party, the LDP. This puts her in line to become Japan's first ever female prime minister.
That sounds like a huge step forward, especially given Japan's record on women in politics.
Symbolically, it is massive. The article notes Japan ranks lowest among all G7 nations when it comes to the political empowerment of women. So having a woman potentially reach the very top job is significant representationally.
But there's a but.
There's a significant but. The article contextualizes this by pointing out that Takahashi is a hardline conservative. She's often compared to Britain's Margaret Thatcher in terms of her political ideology.
So not necessarily a progressive figure.
Not at all. Analysts widely expect her to promote traditional views on female roles in society, alongside nationalistic policies. So while her rise is symbolically important, breaking that ultimate glass ceiling, it doesn't necessarily signal brighter prospects for Japanese women seeking progressive reforms or greater gender equality in practice. It's a victory for female representation, perhaps, but not necessarily for feminism or progressive politics.
Okay, interesting nuance there. Let's dive into the culture section now, specifically the entertainment world. Netflix looms large, particularly this deep dive into the final season of Stranger Things.
Yeah, this piece really highlights the enormous business stakes involved when you have a cultural phenomenon like Stranger Things reaching its end. The scale is just mind-boggling.
What kind of budget are we talking about for this final season?
Reports cited suggest somewhere between $50 million and $60 million per episode.
Per episode. That's movie money.
Easily. For the whole final season, we're looking at nearly $500 million. It underscores just how valuable this single show is to Netflix. It's still their most valuable original property, apparently generating over $1 billion in revenue just since 2020 through merchandise, licensing, etc.
So the pressure to stick the landing must be immense.
Unbelievable pressure. The creators, the Duff brothers, are quoted as being keenly aware of the intense fan backlash that followed the Game of Thrones finale. They are desperate to avoid that fate.
How are they planning to end it? Any hints?
They talk about needing to finally unleash hell on Main Street, suggesting they really are going to go big, likely involving the destruction of Hawkins and providing a definitive, hopefully satisfying conclusion.
And Netflix needs this win badly.
More than ever, it seems. The article points out their dominance on the Nielsen streaming charts is slipping. They used to count for maybe 80% of the top 10 streaming shows back in 2021. Now, midway through this year, that's down to 52%.
Competition is heating up.
Fiercely. Plus, there's this interesting tidbit. The Duffer brothers recently signed a new overall deal, but with Paramount, guaranteeing them theatrical releases for future projects.
Yeah.
That raises questions about their long-term exclusive commitment to just the streaming model. Maybe they want big screen projects, too.
How is Netflix releasing this final season all at once?
No, they're doing something different, clearly designed to maximize buzz and prevent spoilers from leaking too early. They're splitting the final season into three distinct parts.
Three parks. When?
Part one drops just before Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Part two lands on Christmas Day itself. And the final batch arrives on New Year's Eve. It's a very aggressive strategy to dominate holiday viewing and keep people talking about it for weeks.
A calculated play for maximum cultural impact. Okay, staying with Netflix, but a very different show. Nobody wants this. Season two apparently tries to fix some problems from season one.
Yeah, season one got some significant criticism, particularly around his portrayal of Jewish women, often relying on what critics felt were lazy or mean-spirited stereotypes.
Yeah.
The character Esther was often singled out.
So what changed for season two?
They brought in new showrunners, Jenny Connor and Bruce Eric Kaplan, and their focus was reportedly on deepening those side characters, giving them more nuance beyond just being foils for the main couple. They also brought in heavyweight talent, like Tova Feldshuh, to play Noah's mother, Bina, adding more depth there.
Did the core conflict of the show shift?
According to Connor, yes. She said season two moves beyond the initial Judaism 101 clash. You know, the culture shock between Joanne, played by Kristen Bell, and Rabbi Noah, played by Adam Brody. Instead, it delves more into the complexities and pressures of a long-term interfaith relationship, specifically focusing on the mounting pressure Joanne feels about potentially converting.
So, trying for more relatability.
That seems to be the goal, making the characters feel more relatable, even if they aren't always likable. For example, the character Esther evolves from just being a sort of mean girl antagonist into someone who actually becomes a supportive friend to Joanne, adding layers that were missing before. It sounds like a conscious effort to course correct based on the feedback.
One more cultural piece, Ben Stiller's documentary about his parents.
Yes, Stiller and Mira, Nothing is Lost. It sounds like an incredibly intimate and revealing look at his legendary comedian parents, Jerry Stiller and Ann Mira.
What makes it so intimate?
He apparently uses a lot of private, candid recordings, maybe audio tapes from home, and these reveal how the famous comedic bickering they perfected on stage often mirrored real, sometimes quite raw, tension and arguments they had in their actual marriage.
So it's not just a tribute, it's more complex.
Exactly. Stiller realized he couldn't just make a simple, glowing tribute. He had to grapple with the complexity of their relationship, both the brilliance and the difficulties, and also reflect honestly on what he himself inherited from them. The comedic talent, yes, but maybe also some of the personal dynamics or shortcomings. It sounds like a really powerful, honest look behind the curtain of a beloved comedy duo.
Okay, for our final segment, let's look at some broader economic engines and cultural explorations featured in the magazine, starting with this partnered content section on Egypt. They seem to be charting a pretty ambitious path to prosperity.
They really are laying out a multi-pronged strategy, heavily focused on modernization and leveraging technology.
What's the tech angle?
A huge government investment in the ICT sector, information and communications technology. They've allocated $2.5 billion for the 2025-2026 plan alone. A big part of this is creating these innovation hubs called digital creativity centers across the country.
What do those centers do?
They provide resources, training, mentorship, basically fostering tech startups and digital talent locally. They're aiming to have 27 of these centers operational this year. It's about building that digital infrastructure from the ground up.
What about the financial sector?
There's a focus on the Export Development Bank of Egypt, or EBank, under its CEO, Dr. Ahmed Mohamed Galal. It's apparently transformed itself from being just a specialized bank focused on exports into a much broader commercial powerhouse.
Any signs of success?
The article mentions a really impressive return on investment, ROI, of 49%. And they're actively trying to grow their retail banking side, aiming to double it from 15% of their business. It shows a successful pivot towards serving the wider Egyptian economy.
The healthcare transformation sounds particularly ambitious. Universal coverage.
That's the stated goal, achieving universal health coverage for Egypt's massive population of 107 million people. But they also have a second goal running in parallel, positioning Egypt as a regional hub for medical tourism.
A medical tourism is a big market, right?
Huge and growing. Global projections estimate it could reach $154 billion by 2030. Egypt clearly wants a piece of that. Leading private groups like Alameda Healthcare Group are central to this push.
How are they ensuring quality, especially if they want international patients?
Alameda is highlighting its international accreditations. All four of its hospitals apparently hold Joint Commission International JCI accreditation, which is a global standard. They're also CAP certified for their labs. It's about meeting those international benchmarks.
Are they addressing local healthcare challenges too, like doctors leaving the country?
Yes, the brain drain issue is a major problem in Egypt, with skilled doctors often resigning from public hospitals for better opportunities abroad. Alameda is trying to counter this by investing heavily in domestic fellowship programs, trying to train and retain top medical talent within Egypt.
What about public hospitals? Are they involved there?
This is interesting. They're using public-private partnerships, or PPPs. Alameda is collaborating with the Ministry of Health, bringing private capital and operational expertise to help co-manage and upgrade state-run facilities. Early results apparently show increased patient satisfaction, suggesting this model might be a pragmatic way to improve the public system.
And technology adoption in healthcare.
They're embracing it. Alameda is launching a new data center in partnership with Dell, and they're integrating artificial intelligence into key areas like radiology diagnostics and optimizing their supply chains. It looks like a blueprint for digital healthcare modernization across the country.
Okay, finally, shifting continents again, there's an advertisement feature on China, specifically the Xinangji region in western Hunan. It's presented as a place of natural beauty and deep history.
Very much so. Geographically, it's fascinating. This area used to be a vast sea millions of years ago, which is why you get these dramatic landscapes today, the Wuling and Suifeng Mountains, winding rivers. Historically, it's known as the source of poetry.
Why the source of poetry?
Because it's where the famous poet Kuai Yuan was exiled about 2,000 years ago. He wrote some of China's most enduring literary masterpieces like Lizao, on Encountering Sorrow while living in this region.
It's also ethnically diverse.
Incredibly diverse. Mm-hmm. Over 64% of the region's 8.2 million people belong to various ethnic minority groups. The main ones mentioned are the Tujia people, centered around the spectacular Zhangjiajie area, the Miao people, and the Dong people.
Is there evidence of this long history?
Yes, the article mentions the Lausacheng ruins. This is a UNESCO World Cultural Heritage Site, preserving the remains of the capital of the Tusi chieftain system, a unique form of local governance by ethnic minority leaders that lasted for centuries.
And the landscape itself is famous. Avatar Mountains.
Exactly. The incredible soaring sandstone peak forests of Wulingyuan, often shrouded in mist, were the direct visual inspiration for the floating Hallelujah Mountains in James Cameron's movie Avatar. It's a truly otherworldly landscape.
And there's a cultural exchange element mentioned, too.
Yes, the piece highlights the Discover China program. It's organized by Beijing Foreign Studies University, BFSU, and brings students, mainly from the U.S. and Europe, over for study tours.
What do they study?
They get lectures on contemporary Chinese economics and technology, but they also visit historical sites like the Forbidden City in Beijing and modern businesses, like the showroom for NIO electric vehicles.
What's the goal of these tours?
The stated goal is explicitly cross-cultural understanding. Letting foreign students experience China firsthand, interact with people, and see that despite political systems or cultural differences, there are often shared core principles and values, an effort to bridge understanding.
Okay, so we've covered just an incredible range in this issue, almost contradictory in a way, from the absolute depths of human suffering in Eli Shorabi's hostage account.
And the shadow economy's funding conflict through things like illicit gold.
To the fragility of democratic norms facing this rise of soft fascism.
Right, but then balanced, almost jarringly, by this immense scientific and technological promise, the potential cure for Huntington's through gene therapy.
And the sheer speed of innovation in areas like AI and robotics, with things like the Figaro 3 promising to completely reshape labor for better or worse.
The big takeaway for you, the listener, has to be the importance of looking beyond the surface noise, right? Understanding the real human cost behind a conflict or the environmental cost behind that gold necklace.
Or recognizing the subtle legalistic ways democracy can be undermined or the complex ethical debates surrounding new technologies like baby boxes or AI. It's about grasping the details to be truly informed.
And what really stands out, connecting almost everything, is this theme of acceleration. Technology is moving so fast, arguably outpacing our ability to create the political and social frameworks needed to manage it wisely.
Which brings us to that final lingering question, particularly from the robotics piece. It feels urgent.
It absolutely is. Given this accelerating pace of innovation, especially in AI and robotics, that could, as Adcock suggests, collapse the value of human labor.
How quickly do our policy frameworks, things like universal basic income, education systems, social safety nets, how quickly do they need to be fundamentally reimagined?
Reimagined to prevent what that expert warned about. The creation of a permanent, maybe massive underclass whose labor society simply no longer needs.
That really feels like the critical question hanging over so much of this. Will this wave of change lift everyone up or leave huge numbers behind?
It determines whether the future's undeniable technological wealth becomes a widespread blessing, or just another version of a geopolitical curse, concentrating power and exacerbating inequality. A lot to think about.
Indeed. Well, thanks for diving in with us on this comprehensive look at Time Magazine, October 27th, 2025.
Yeah, we really appreciate you joining us for this deep dive. We'll talk to you next time.